This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We're the best entertained and least informed people on the face of the earth, and we cannot keep our international leadership or our democracy if we don't have an informed public that is capable of recognizing all the milestones of tyranny and telling the truth from fiction.
Coming up on Radio EcoShock, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. lays out the black truth about fossil fuels and his vision of a new energy economy. I'm Alex Smith. The team of hurricanes and tropical storms that worked up the East Coast set a bunch of records. Binghamton, New York had an extreme rainfall event higher than ever recorded. The whole Susquehanna River Valley flooded all the way down, Pennsylvania down into Maryland. Spring floods? Sure, we expect that. Now we have fall floods? A couple of weeks ago, it was wet, wet, wet all around the D.C. area, as you know. As the chief meteorologist for the Capital Weather Gang reported, the rain in the first and second week of September was just off the charts. How about September 8th, when Fort Belvoir, the Army base in Fairfax County, Virginia, the National Weather Service reported 7 inches of rain there in 3 hours. Quote, it was off the charts above a 1,000-year rainfall based on the precipitation frequency measured from Quantico. End quote. There was a 1 in 50 or 100-year rainfall near Ellicott City, Maryland, 5.47 inches in 3 hours near Franconia in Virginia, a 1 in 500-year rainfall event there. The whole D.C.-Baltimore metro area rainfall hit levels that might be expected every 10 to 25 years. Joe Rome at Climate Progress reminds us it's been a terrible year for extreme rainfall this year. Think about Nashville's Katrina, the 1 in 1,000-year crazy flooding there, and coastal North Carolina experienced a second 500-year rainfall in just the last 11 years. And what about that deadly flood that hit Queensland, Australia in January 2011 after a long, long drought? People, cars, and buildings were washed away. They are called extreme precipitation events. We have changed the atmosphere. Globally warmer air now holds 4% more water vapor than in just 1970. That doesn't sound like much until it falls on your head and your home. If the local weather is cold enough, the extreme moisture falls as snow. Not that anybody in Washington would remember last winter's unusually heavy dump. Only the idiots who deny climate science thought it was a sure sign of global cooling. Coming up, we'll hear about another huge rain disaster in Pakistan, dengue fever panic, and how that tropical disease is coming to America thanks to climate change. But first, a little blast from the past as Radio EcoShock reaches back to a program called The Unknown Climate on April 9, 2010, warning listeners about global wetting, the new hard rains predicted by science. In fact, as you'll hear, we asked American climate scientist Noah Diffenbaugh about the extreme precipitation way back in 2007. Maybe you saw Dr. Diffenbaugh on Al Gore's 24 Hours of Reality broadcast last week. And if you missed that, just go to climaterealityproject.org. You can find all our past programs where scientists, authors, and experts tell you what to expect in the coming times free at ecoshock.org. Help yourself to the downloads of MP3 shows there. Here's a clip from our April 2010 program.
Melbourne's main streets became raging torrents as the city was drenched by nearly 30 millimetres in less than 60 minutes.
From Rhode Island to Rio to Queensland, 100-year floods, 200-year floods, all-time record rains happening all over the world. And as TV tells it, everyone is just a freak storm or the power of El Nino. The state of Rhode Island went underwater. The whole New England coast was pounded with days of record rains. When it stopped, the weather jerked into sudden summer heat. It's all part of the unknown climate. Who would have guessed? Maybe Radio EcoShock listeners 3 years ago, as I interviewed scientist Noah Diffenbaugh about extreme rainfall events. And in 2005, your team released one of the most detailed climate model predictions for North America. Can you tell us about that?
Well, we found that elevated greenhouse gas concentrations substantially increase the frequency of extreme precipitation events, and also the contribution of those events to the total annual precipitation. So not only do the heaviest events become more frequent as greenhouse gas concentrations rise, but they also represent a larger fraction of the total precipitation that comes during the year.
Now that many Americans have been washed out and a few drowned by extreme rainfall, it's a good time to understand this underreported story coming out of Pakistan right now. And yes, there is plenty to learn about what can happen here. You remember the TV footage from 2010 when about one-fifth of Pakistan simply went underwater and stayed that way for over a month and more? Over 2,000 people died, and almost 20 million of the poorest people in the world were left homeless. Now it is happening again, as monsoon rains pumped up by climate change have flooded the southern part of the country, the Sindh area, next door to India's Punjab. I didn't really hear about this one in the mainstream media. It broke into an email discussion I was having with a Radio EcoShock listener in Karachi, the port city at the very south of Pakistan. Thanks to the magic of podcasts and downloads, we have listeners from all over the world. Author and eco-activist Khalid Hassan wrote about a new documentary, the first green documentary released in Pakistan. It is called Murder of Mystic and shows another disaster, the fast-disappearing mangroves. As in most places of the world, the wealthy people and the top middle class want to build new houses on oceanfront, so they chop down the mangrove, what they call swamps, to create a clear view and maybe some beachfront. The land grabbers in Pakistan just hack down these low-lying trees with their many roots, which are the spawning grounds for loads of marine life, including the fish that support some of Pakistan's poorest fisher people. Mangroves also deflect the first signs of rising seas because they buffer the coast and help hold on to the coastline, keeping it intact during storm surges. A mangrove forest does a much better job than somebody's lawn and palatial home. The irony is, millionaires, who produce so much more carbon emissions than the rest of us flying around with their many homes, they'll lose all that valuable oceanfront first, as the sea rises. In the film Murder of Mystic by Outfield Productions, we also learn that mangroves are very tough to replace. After the real estate moguls hack it down, along come some well-meaning environment groups to replace them. There was even a contest in the Sindh area of Pakistan and nearby India to replant the most number of mangroves for the Guinness World Book of Records. Few of those plantings survived. The mangroves take years to establish themselves, and nature is complex. Mangrove forests cannot easily be replaced. The best way is to save what exists. But that kind of anti-real estate activism can be dangerous in Pakistan, as it is in many countries. We need to keep a careful eye on the safety of those who speak out. Find a few brief clips from The Murder of Mystic on YouTube. While Khalid and I discussed this, he wrote with amazing news. The streets of Karachi were flooding as never before. Sure, it's common for some flooding during monsoon season. They've seen that, we've seen that. But this was something else. The whole southern state of Sindh was just coming off a punishing 12-month drought. The monsoons were hoped for as a relief. Then on September 14th, rains, beyond belief, descended. Hundreds drowned. At least 2 million people are homeless in Sindh and Balochistan provinces. The United Nations is again appealing for aid. And remember, those 800,000 people from last year's floods are still homeless and need help. Karachi, Pakistan's largest city, with somewhere around 25 million people maybe in the greater metropolitan area, it was more or less shut down by flooding, the lights went out, the city stopped functioning, and then the refugees from the drowned rural areas all around came in their own human flood toward the city. Find the latest news at www.dawn.com. Pakistan's greatest weather and climate scientists have no doubt this latest extreme flooding is another result of climate change. We find this quote from an article September 18th by Mr. Waqar Bhatti. Rains in Sindh are the highest ever recorded monsoon rains during the 4 weeks period. Since this year received 270% and 1,170% above normal monsoon rains, respectively, in August and September, he said, adding that in just 4 weeks, the otherwise dry, arid region received rainfall which was close to what it got normally in 5 years. Though sometimes it is difficult to relate extreme weather events to climate change, if we look at the frequency and the trend of extreme weather events happening in Pakistan during the last 2 decades, it is easy to find its connection with climate change, said Dr. Komar-uz-Zaman Chowdhury, Advisor Climate Affairs and Vice President of the World Meteorological Organization, Asia Region, on Thursday. Okay, so now the kicker, which warns everyone of the many nasty side effects of climate change. dengue fever has hit the flood victims of Pakistan. You may not know about dengue fever, but this formerly tropical disease is hovering around the southern United States. There have been 12 cases this year in Florida alone and a few more in Texas. The Bahamas has an outbreak of dengue fever right now. If you need a dose of celebrity news, singer Rihanna's father was just hospitalized with dengue fever, picked up at Rihanna's home in Barbados. On September 15th, the Los Angeles Times reported the tropical mosquito that carries dengue fever and malaria was found in the San Gabriel Valley right near Los Angeles, California. You may want to take a minute to learn to recognize this bug. The scientific name is Aedes albopictus. Most people call it the Asian tiger mosquito. It's a tiger because the more you swat it, the more it attacks. And this one bites in the middle of the day, not in the early morning or evening, as most North American mosquitoes do. Those are the two signs, aggressive and bites in the daytime. This insect is easy to identify. It is a smaller mosquito, but the legs and body are black with white patches or stripes. If you see little white markings on the legs of a mosquito, you've found it. In the recent Pakistan floods in Karachi and all around, extending even to Lahore, there is panic now that dengue fever has set in. That's a disease you'll want to learn about as our climate heats up. Dengue fever has been called bone break fever. It hits very hard. People feel like they are dying, so they flock towards medical help, towards the hospitals. Here is a news clip from Al Jazeera, September 15th, on the dengue panic in Pakistan.
Hundreds of people make a beeline to a government hospital to get their blood tested. This woman has high fever, a common symptom besides headache and nausea. And even though she may be fearing for her life, doctors say the mortality rate from the dengue virus is less than 1%. Lack of awareness and fear-mongering has led to nothing short of panic. A media hype about the dangers of the disease and a politicization of the issue has led people to panic. They're now congregating at the hospitals, putting a severe strain on the hospital systems.
If a dengue test is not positive,
Dr. Salahuddin Khan is in charge of the dengue control program at Jinnah Hospital in Lahore and says they have even turned their conference rooms into dengue wards. He says there is now a gradual understanding of this mysterious virus.
As the time is passing, the panic is subsiding. I wouldn't call it a real panic, but I would say that there was some semblance of a panicky situation for some people, not knowing too much about the disease, or perhaps fear creeps in. But the situation in the hospital is totally under control.
The doctor said that out of 4,000 tests, only 17 turned positive, squashing rumors that thousands had died from dengue fever. The hospital is full of patients, and even the corridors are now makeshift wards to deal with the crisis.
Part of the point is most victims do not die of dengue fever, and they think they have it when they don't. Although you can die, most people survive after that violent illness. Keeping hydrated, lowering the temperature with aspirin or Tylenol or cooling baths, that is the treatment. But we can expect a similar panic if dengue fever breaks out for real in North America or even southern Europe, where people are fearful of this unknown tropical disease. If there are mosquitoes in the hospital itself, as happens in some less developed countries, then those flocking to hospitals may be at greater risk. Dengue fever is transferred by mosquito bites and cannot otherwise pass from person to person. Close the windows or put up screens, and you are safe to treat your loved one who has dengue fever. Learn to recognize the mosquito and the disease, and avoid panic. The real solution is to limit the amount of climate change we cause. Maybe we can prevent tropical bugs and their diseases from arriving. That is our goal at Radio EcoShock, to prevent as much as we can climate change. I'm Alex Smith. Did you know your body is already toxic with mercury from coal plants? And why doesn't the media tell you the truth about climate change? Get ready for a blockbuster speech from Robert F. Kennedy Jr., courtesy of the Climate One Project at the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Greg Dalton. Flick on a light switch in the United States, and chances are you'll be poking your finger into a coal mine somewhere in the country. About half of the nation's electricity is supplied by coal, thanks in part to policies from the 1970s that favor the abundant American source of energy. But coal is also among the dirtiest fossil fuels and a major source of carbon pollution that is driving global weirding. Should the United States move away from coal to cleaner power? Should it make coal itself cleaner? One of coal's biggest critics is Robert F. Kennedy Jr., noted author, attorney, and environmental advocate. He's featured in the new documentary film, The Last Mountain, which depicts the lives of people in the coal mining towns of Appalachia. For the next hour, Mr. Kennedy and our live audience in San Francisco will discuss the extraction and combustion of coal, as well as broader national energy issues. So please welcome Robert F. Kennedy to the Commonwealth Club. Thank you for coming. So a lot of the preference for coal goes back to the 1970s when American policy sort of gave deliberate preference to a U.S. source of energy. A lot of presidents have promised energy independence. They haven't delivered it yet. What do you think America should do for a comprehensive national energy policy?
Well, you know, for 27 years, I've been an environmental advocate for 27 years, and for 27 years I've had the same answer to that question, which is free market capitalism. People say to me, what's the most important environmental law that we could pass? And I would say, I've always said the same thing. It's free market capitalism, because in a true free market promotes efficiency, and efficiency means the elimination of waste, and pollution is waste. And a true free market would encourage us to properly value our natural resources, and it is the undervaluation of those resources that causes us to use them wastefully. But in a true free market, you can't make yourself rich without making your neighbors rich and without enriching your community. But what polluters do is they make themselves rich by making everybody else poor. They raise standards of living for themselves by lowering quality of life for everybody else, and they do that by escaping the discipline of the free market. You show me a polluter, I'll show you a subsidy. I'll show you a fat cat using political clout to escape the discipline of the free market and force the public to pay his production costs. And coal claims to be cheap, but actually it's probably the most catastrophically expensive way to boil a pot of water that has ever been devised. If I spend a lot of time in West Virginia over the past 2.5 decades. I had a 6.5 week jury trial in West Virginia about a year and a half ago, and I won the biggest judgment in the history of the state. I was back in the state about 3 months ago arguing the appeal of that judgment before the West Virginia Supreme Court. And as I was leaving the state, I was driving on a highway that felt like I was driving on a cushion. It was so soft, and it was almost like a skateboard park. That's very unusual in West Virginia. West Virginia is the 49th poorest state. My father used to say, coal claims to be bringing prosperity to this state, but it's got a state with the richest resources in our country, but it has the 49th poorest people. And coal has brought poverty and destruction and a disability and dysfunction to this state, not prosperity. But good roads are hard to find in West Virginia. And I asked the driver, why does it feel like we're driving on a cushion? He said, because there's 22 inches of asphalt on this road. And the reason I knew the Massachusetts Turnpike has 4 to 6 inches. The New York State Thruway is 6 to 8 inches. Every inch of asphalt costs the taxpayer millions of dollars. And I knew the reason they had 22 inches of asphalt, because the coal trucks weigh 90,000 pounds and they'll pulverize less robust roads. So when coal says that the coal industry is not paying for that 22 inches of asphalt, and that road has to be repaired every 4 years, whereas a regular highway has to be repaired every 20 years. So, and it's not the coal industry that's paying that bill. It's you and I, the taxpayer. So coal says it's cheap. They say we're only 11 cents a kilowatt hour. But they're not telling you you're also paying for those 3,000 miles of coal roads in West Virginia. That's coming out of a different pocket. Last year, the National Academy of Sciences said that a 10-year study they completed that showed that every single freshwater fish in America now has dangerous levels of mercury in its flesh. That mercury is coming from coal-burning power plants. One out of every 6 American women now have so much mercury in her womb from eating those fish and from other vectors that her children are at a grim risk for a grim inventory of diseases: autism, blindness, mental retardation, heart, liver, and kidney disease. I have so much mercury in my body. I got my levels tested recently, and I fish a lot, and I eat the fish. My levels are 10 times what EPA considers safe. And I was told by Dr. David Carpenter, who is the National Authority on Mercury Contamination, that a woman with my levels of mercury in her blood would have children with cognitive impairment, with permanent brain injury. Well, today, according to CDC, there are 647,000 children born in this country every year who've been exposed to dangerous levels of mercury in their mother's wombs. That's a cost on our country that they don't tell you about when they say, oh, it's only 11 cents a kilowatt hour. Last week, Harvard published a study, a peer-reviewed study by Paul Epstein, that showed the cost of coal from the cost of health impacts to our national health system just from ozone and particulates is $345 billion a year. And that's part of the cost of burning coal. 10 million asthma attacks a year, a million lost work days. I live 2 hours south of the Adirondack Mountains. This is the oldest protected wilderness on the face of the earth. It's generations of Americans had the rightful expectation that they would be able to enjoy those landscapes unspoiled. But today, one-fifth of the lakes in the Adirondacks is sterilized, dead from acid rain, which has also destroyed the forest cover on the high peaks of the Appalachians from Georgia to northern Quebec. And those of you who see the movie will see what's happened, which is that this industry has, over the past 10 years, they've cut down the 500 biggest mountains in West Virginia. They've flattened an area of Appalachia larger than the state of Delaware. If you filled 25 feet of a Hudson River stream, we would put you in jail. If you blew up a mountain in the Sierras up here, or in Utah or Colorado or the Berkshires, or in Appalachia, you would go to jail or you'd be put someplace for the criminally insane. But in Appalachia, they're able to cut down 500 mountains, and it's all illegal. And they've been able to bury not 25 feet of streams, but 2,500 miles of rivers and streams. And they do it by subverting democracy. This is, and by hiding what they're doing from the public. Because what they're doing is illegal. You saw me ask Bill Rainey, who's the head of the Coal Association, and I asked the same thing in a debate last year with the head of the CEO of Massey Coal. I said to him, you've had, by your own records, 67,000 violations in 5 years and tens of thousands of violations of other mining and safety laws. Can you make a profit in your industry without breaking the law? And he said, no. He acknowledged he does operate a criminal enterprise. His business plan is to break the law and then to disable, to subvert democracy so that the law is not enforced against him. And that destruction of democracy is another cost of coal that they don't tell you about when they say it's only 11 cents a kilowatt hour. We give to the oil industry $1.3 trillion in subsidies every year. If you don't believe that figure, look at Terry Tamminen's new book, Lives Per Gallon, which Terry Tamminen just stepped down as head of California EPA, and he has meticulously and scrupulously inventoried the vast raft of subsidies that we give to oil every year. This is the richest industry in the history of the world. We borrow $1 billion a day in our country. People talk about, the trade imbalance with China. Well, that's nothing compared to the trade imbalance with the oil countries. We borrow $1 billion a day, mainly from nations that don't share our values, in order to import $1 billion of oil a day. A lot, again, largely from nations that don't share our values. And this hemorrhage of $750 billion annually of American wealth has beggared a nation that, when I was a little boy, owned half the wealth on the face of the planet. Our deadly addiction to carbon is the principal drag on American capitalism. Now, in last year in November, Lord David Putnam gave a speech before Parliament. When Parliament was debating a cap-and-trade system that's very similar, but actually much tougher, than the one that we passed in Congress, and then that was defeated in the Senate, and it was the mainstay of President Obama's national energy policy. And to its credit, Parliament ultimately passed that bill. But there, In our country, half the people don't believe that global warming exists because of, and I was talking to somebody a few minutes ago, they said, why is that? Well, it's because the propaganda works. And Exxon and Koch brothers have spent $200 million, erecting phony think tanks and filling them with these phony scientists who we call biostitutes and employing these slick PR firms to persuade the American public that global warming doesn't exist, and propaganda works. Joseph Goebbels used to say, talk about the big lie. If you tell it again and again and again, ultimately people will believe it. And that's what's happening. But in Great Britain, they haven't experienced that. People generally accept the science. They understand that it's a grim reality that government has to take a strong hand in enforcing. And ultimately, Parliament passed the bill. But there's still vested interest in other people in England who said that, we have to move incrementally. We have to move slowly because if we move precipitously, it's going to cause grave dislocations in the marketplace and our economy. That's going to impede our ability to address this and other issues. And it's going to be bad for our country. And Lord Putnam reminded Parliament that exactly 200 years before, the same body had debated the abolition of the slave trade. And at that time, everybody in England believed that slavery was an abomination, a moral catastrophe that had to be abolished. But people said, how do we do it? Because slavery represented 25% of the GNP of Great Britain. It was the principal source of energy for the entire British Empire. And they said, if we abolish it outright, the economy is going to crater. But after a year of debate, Parliament made the moral choice and abolished slavery literally overnight. And instead of collapsing, the British economy exploded as thousands of entrepreneurs rushed into that space to create new forms of energy, mainly mechanical ones, in an era that we now know as the Industrial Revolution, which was the greatest epic in wealth creation in the history of mankind. And the abolition of the slave trade had exposed all of these hidden inefficiencies that were associated with free human bondage. Well, today, we don't need to abolish carbon in this country in order to understand that our deadly addiction to it is the principal enemy to America's prosperity, to our leadership, to our national security, to the values that make us proud to be part of this country, to the historic role that my family always believed in of America as an exemplary nation. We do know this, that every nation that has decarbonized its society has experienced instantaneous wealth. Iceland in 1970 was the poorest country in Europe. It was 100% dependent on imported coal and oil. The government of Iceland, mainly because they were frightened of global warming, which impacts the northern latitudes disproportionately, decided to decarbonize their society. But again, you had vested interests in others who tried to hold back and impede that process. But the government moved very deliberately. But during that period, Iceland became 100% energy independent. So 95% of Iceland's electric grid now comes from local geothermal. And Iceland went from, during that 15-year period, from being the poorest country in Europe to being the fourth richest country by GDP on Earth.
You're listening to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. speaking at the Commonwealth Club of California, courtesy of the Climate One Project. Find out more at commonwealthclub.org. This is Radio EcoShock, and we'll be right back in 1 minute with more from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Don't miss it.